Welcome to Intersections, the podcast where two experts explore and explain important policy issues in the world today. We're part of the Brookings Podcast Network, and I'm your host, Adriana Pita. We've got something of a special episode today. You probably noticed when you downloaded it that it's a little longer than usual. As we look back on the 25 years since Israeli, Palestinian, and American negotiators signed the Oslo Accords in the hopes of achieving a viable two-state solution, it's an apt moment to bring together two former colleagues who worked together in Israel, Palestine, and Washington during the 90s and the 2000s. Recently reunited here at Brookings as fellows with our foreign policy program, Salam Fayyad, the former Prime Minister and Minister of Finance of the Palestinian Authority, and Jeff Feltman, the former U.S. Ambassador and Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, sat down with Natan Sachs, the director of our Center for Middle East Policy, to share their personal stories from inside the days of the Oslo process, the building and reforming of civic institutions in Palestine, and the Second Intifada. In addition to looking back, Fayyad and Feltman will reflect on the current political environments inside the United States, Palestine, and Israel, and the prospects for the future of peace. Now, let me turn it over to Natan.
Hello, everyone, and thank you very much for joining us. My name is Natan Sachs, and I'm the director of the Center for Middle East Policy here at Brookings. And it's both a pleasure and a true honor for me to be here recording this podcast with our two new additions to our team, the Honorable Salam Fayyad, the former Prime Minister and Finance Minister of the Palestinian Authority, who's been really a champion of Palestinian statehood and independence for a long time, and one of the most respected leaders in the region, I think. He joined the Center for Middle East Policy as a distinguished fellow just recently, and it's truly an honor to have you with us, Salam. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nathan. Thank you very much.
And Jeffrey Feltman, who just recently joined the Foreign Policy Program, and before that was the Undersecretary General of the United Nations, which is basically number three in the whole UN, the old political issues reported to Jeff at the UN. And before that, a very distinguished career in Middle East affairs. He was Assistant Secretary for Near East Affairs in the State Department, and ambassador to Lebanon, and a diplomat in Tel Aviv, and the acting consul general in Jerusalem, and time in Baghdad, and I can go on and on. One of the most interesting things here is that these two very distinguished colleagues have known each other for quite a while, so I wonder if one of you would tell us how you first met and how you would spend your times then. Salam, would you like to start?
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for this kind, warm introduction, and happy to be with you at Brookings, and especially delighted to be joined with my old friend Jeff for this podcast. I don't know if Jeff recalls this in particular, but your question was specific as to how we really met. It happened at Eretz Checkpoint. I was the IMF press rep at the time.
And so this is the entry to the Gaza Strip.
Beginning December 1995. That's when I actually assumed that office and started to do that job. Didn't take too long. I used to travel from Jerusalem. I lived with my family in Jerusalem. And I used to travel to Gaza just about daily. I had a little apartment that sometimes when I ended up spending too much time late in the evening, I wouldn't travel back. I stayed there. One day, not long after I really started doing this, a gentleman walked up to me and he said, "Hey, you're the IMF guy, aren't you?" It was Jeff Feltman. That's when we met. That's how it happened. He used to probably make same or similar trips, and I was new there, and he just walked up to me like this, and I said yes, and that was the start of it. And it was really most productive and best relations I had, and especially privileged to really be joined back at this forum. Didn't take too long before he really started to really actually visit with me regularly in my office in Gaza, driving himself, hard to believe these days, a U.S. diplomat, traveling from Tel Aviv to Gaza, driving his own car, beat up Chevy, blue one, I remember.
Yep.
And he would stop by, went between meetings, talking to people, getting some data on what's getting into Gaza, imports, things like this for his job. And between meetings, he would stop by without calling or anything like that. I was there most of the time, and oftentimes we had lunch together. That had a certain name to it. I don't know if I'm really wanting to really say what it was, but in any event, that was really the start of what really was a very, very productive relationship, even during those days, beginning with the time when I was resident representative. I'm maybe going too long, but I remember in the spring of 1996, the PA, it came to my knowledge that the Minister of Finance issued a bad check. And that to me was a shocker. I mean, how can a Minister of Finance write a bad check? So that, to me, the lowly IMF res rep at the time, was kind of really an ominous sign of a PA about to collapse. I mean, if we really got to a point where the Minister of Finance is issuing bad checks, so it must be that they really are in bad shape. Lo and behold, I get in touch with Jeff, and I say, listen, I mean, things are really in bad way here. What's happening? I remember vividly, this is how productive the gentleman was and extremely into what he was doing. Really, if ever met people with, you know, that kind of dedication and to what they were doing and deep personal interest. I remember receiving several phone calls from him that day, like 15 minutes later, half an hour later. We start from nothing, and by noon that day, he was able, on the strength of contacts that he made, he was on the phone, we got to $10 million. I can't really make available to the PA at the time. I mean,
it's the age of the like Palestinian Authority.
So I can't go on. I mean, this is really not something that I can do justice to in span of an answer to a question like yours, but we can go on with just really an incredible, remarkable journey.
So this is the early days of the Oslo process, which was signed in September 13th, actually, 1993. So we're now 25 years since the Oslo process, and it's a moment of kind of thinking back. So Jeff, if you think back of those days, could you tell us how you got involved in all this? You're a young diplomat in the Tel Aviv embassy at the time, is that right?
Yeah, at the time, the embassy in Tel Aviv, for historic reasons, had two or three, depending on how you counted them, Gaza watchers. And I was the economic commercial Gaza watcher. And it was separate from the consulate general in Jerusalem, which was covering the West Bank. Later, this was consolidated into one mission. But at the time, I reported up to the ambassador in Tel Aviv, Martin Indyk, but covering Gaza economic issues. But when I was assigned this portfolio, when I was assigned this position back in early 93, it was a far different job than the job that I ended up having. Because by the time I got to Gaza, after doing the 2 years of Arabic studies that the State Department provided me, a great benefit, the Oslo Accords had happened. The Palestinian Authority had come into Gaza and Jericho. There were negotiations on the interim agreement. And there was a whole coordination structure that was set up to try to focus the international community on helping the Palestinian Authority meet its needs. And again, that's how I came to appreciate Salam, because Salam, in these coordination meetings, was always practical, pragmatic, focused. And it's also why I stopped by his office several times a week, was to sort of compare notes with him, because Salam would not have written a bad check. And so we were able to work together to figure out some of the stuff. And also, to be frank, I was living in Tel Aviv. My job was in Gaza. I had no office in Gaza. I needed to stop someplace to use the bathroom.
Oh, that's a good way to go.
You know, it's hard to talk about the genesis of our relationship without mentioning another friend, Jake Wallace, who at the time was DPO in Jerusalem.
The number two at the consulate in Jerusalem.
Yeah, number two at the consulate in Jerusalem.
And I should say the consulate in Jerusalem serves in many respects as the diplomatic, the liaison to the Palestinians.
Yes, pretty much. And I don't know what happened. I think you left, you came back, because a number of years between 1996, when we first met in early 1996, to the times when I first joined the PA in June 2002, he at the time was acting consul general, I believe.
I had the Gaza job from 95 to 98. From 98 to 2000, I was in Tunis. I had transferred to the embassy in Tunis. Martin Indyk insisted I come back to work on the Israeli-Palestinian issues in 2000, initially from Tel Aviv, but then at the consulate in Jerusalem, where I was the number two, the deputy principal officer, but there was no number one after July of 2002, so I became the acting consul general, the acting head diplomatic representative of the Palestinians. And you were still IMF at the time
I remember.
So I want to come back to your experience as a finance minister with no bad checks written. But before that, Jeff, could you tell us a little bit about the experience working in the embassy in Tel Aviv, liaison with the Israelis, how you met the Israeli leadership maybe the first time? How it was compared to Jerusalem, a very different place.
I had two entirely different experiences in Tel Aviv, because the first tour in Tel Aviv, I was covering the Gaza Strip. I was working with Salam Fayyad, with the Palestinians who were then, it seemed to be, on a forward trajectory. So I was very much focused on Gaza, and my relationship were developed mostly with the Palestinians, with the exception that Martin Indyk was the ambassador. I was very lucky to have Martin Indyk as the ambassador. He sort of took me under his wing directly, and he would bring me with him to meetings with the Israelis to tell the Israelis what I was seeing in Gaza.
And at the time, it's Yitzhak Rabin, Shimon Peres, these are the leaders.
Yes. The second time I was in Tel Aviv, I was his special assistant, meaning I was with him in all of the meetings that were taking place during his second tour around the Camp David process at the time. And then when I was in Jerusalem, of course, I was part of the U.S. representation diplomatic mission to the Palestinians. I want to go back to sort of the early Gaza period, because I think it gives an example of just how pragmatic at the time many people were. Not everyone. There was a lot of ideology at play on many, but there was also a pragmatism. Because of the terrorism that had increased after the signing of the Oslo Accords, the Israelis imposed an ever stiffer closure onto the Gaza Strip, you know, restricting truck movement, labor movement, et cetera. And at one point, they cut off the ability of Palestinian trucks to go to Israel to pick up fuel, or Israeli fuel trucks to go into Gaza Strip to deliver fuel. And so there was suddenly no ability to get fuel. Well, you know, comparing ideas with Salam, comparing ideas with others, we came up with this idea that you build a terminal across the, it's not a border, but across the line between Gaza and Israel, where simply the Israeli truck is on the Israeli side, downloads through a pipe, it goes into the Palestinian truck on the Palestinian side to be delivered to where the fuel is needed. And the Israelis who Martin Indyk took me to see were very pragmatic. They saw the need that you had to have fuel in order to have electricity, sewage treatment, et cetera, et cetera. And so they quickly agreed and was able to help us cut through all the permit issues we'd had before. It was a pragmatic way of looking at a very real problem imposed because of the Israeli closures that were a security measure designed to counter the terrorism threat.
It's interesting, this issue of how to deal specifically with fuel getting into Gaza, but everything else, of course, is back now with a vengeance of 10 years now, more than 10 years of closure on Gaza. But we're still sort of, we're thinking of the period in the 90s, I suppose, between the signing of Oslo in late 93 and the outbreak of the second Intifada in late 2000. These are years that you mentioned a lot of pragmatism. There's ups and downs in those years, but a lot of pragmatism, but a lot changes in 2000. In the summer of 2000, the second Camp David summit is convened. It ends in failure. And then in September that year, the second Intifada begins. You were mentioning earlier, we were discussing, Salam, you found yourself in a very interesting place in the second Intifada. You were, in fact, with Yasser Arafat at the Mukata in Ramallah, which is the Palestinian presidential headquarters in Ramallah, that were under siege in 2003 by the Israeli forces and what the Israelis called Operation Defensive Shield. Can you tell us a bit about how that came about and what that was about?
Yeah, I can. You know, it's interesting. I sit with Jeff. We have never done this before. And it's hard for me to kind of listen to him without kind of being reminded of things that really actually happened, and not to kind of comment on, because as he was saying what he was saying about his role at the embassy in Tel Aviv and Martin Indyk and all, he actually introduced me to Martin Indyk when he was ambassador. Very unusual for IMF Rezrab. To kind of be working with the ambassador. I mean, the way...
To Israel, and you were the res rep to the Palestinian Authority.
I remember, actually, it must have happened in 2000. You know, Jeff and I had another thing in common. We both drove ourselves around, mm-hmm. which was a challenge, pre-GPS. Not that it is not a challenge for me these days with GPS, but in any event, I remember I was traveling to Brussels one day, and he suggested that I kind of stop by the embassy and... before actually flying out, and I did. That's when we met, talked about a number of things, including, you know, this was actually before Camp David. This definitely, I believe.
It was like 98.
Before. This actually was after Camp David.
Was it?
I can tell you why I remember. Okay. Because I remember getting to Brussels that day, and that was the day on which the Supreme Court ruled on the elections. Or was that in 90? Yeah. No, that was 2000. Yeah, it was 2000. In any event. So, a lot of memories, actually. But on that, I had just joined the PA mid-2002 as finance minister in June of that year. And as a matter of fact, it didn't take long. I mean, I think the next day, I mean, the after we were sworn in, in Ramallah, myself and three other colleagues who joined the government, was not really government change completely, but it was myself, Minister of Interior, Minister of Labor, and I forgot the fourth, but four of us. And only to find myself holed up in a hotel room in Ramallah under curfew. This was the height of the Second Intifada, and the Israeli army was in the city that imposed curfew. So stayed there for quite a number of days, unable to go actually to the office in Ramallah. We're not talking about Gaza or anything like that. But anyway, weeks, maybe a few months afterwards, and I remember it was in September of that year, it was kind of about less than 3 months after joining the PA, I was to go to Mukata in Ramallah. At the time, I was living in Jerusalem with my family, not really officially and formally, but on a permit visit. Permit. My wife is Jerusalem resident, and but in any event, effectively, yes, I was residing there. And I was called in for a meeting in Mukata with a visiting dignitary to our late president, Yasser Arafat, at the time. Nothing in particular that I could think of as to why I myself would be called for a meeting like that. But in any event, it was not uncommon either. I just joined the PA, and people kind of started to hear about this new Minister of Finance, and the president wanted me around. So it was not a working day, that I remember, for whatever reason. It was not a working day, whether it was a Friday or something, or a holiday. I remember it was kind of afternoon, that September day. And I took a taxi from Jerusalem, went to Ramallah. That same day, there was a bombing bus. And obviously, the thought crossed my mind, given what had preceded that, and the high stakes and rhetoric and all, that this was going to have consequences, that the significant number of fatalities. Nevertheless, I mean, there was no way I was really going to not go. I was going, and I remember the thought crossed my mind that, you know, could it be that your tanks would roll in today and things like this? The thought just crossed my mind, but I just kept going. Got to Mukata only to learn, as soon as I got there, that the meeting had been called off because the visitor had called in saying he's not going to be able to come. Now, knowing who he was, I don't think it was a decision that he himself made without being told, so it was ominous, needless to say. For whatever reason, I didn't kind of leave as soon as I was told there was no meeting. I mean, I saw the president, and I remember kind of having conversation with a colleague of mine at the time in Diyardo Mukata before kind of really hopping on same car that brought me and taking me back to Jerusalem. Just out of nowhere, all of a sudden, I don't know how this can happen. I mean, no prior experience or anything like that. No noise, nothing. I mean, I would have thought that when tanks are moving, you hear the noise of tanks moving. But I could hear nothing. All of a sudden, machine guns, heavy machine gun, and everybody was yelling at everybody, come on in. We're really shoved inside the building, as a matter of fact. And it was, I mean, hilarious how all of this was happening. I mean, it was kind of scary. With all this gunfire and all. But I was kind of reflecting on it, kind of real time. So I remember one of the guards was kind of really wanting to make sure that kind of a door, which is kind of really not much of a door, could not, I think I said to Jeff, could not even stop a fly, going through it. Wanted to make sure the door was closed. I mean, before you know it, we're kind of holed up in the Mukata, under siege.
How long were you there?
We're there about 10 days in all. The next day was very testy. The first day was not that eventful. After the initial round of gunfire and all and tank activity and the rest of it, we could hear some noise. We're inside in the president's own kind of meeting room where he spent most of his time, as a matter of fact, a few of us. And then I remember distinctly that evening, somebody, his office director, I mean, not chief of staff, just coming in and say, apparently they were in touch with the Israelis. He just walked in the room and he said, because there were a number of people in the room, there are some university professors who were called in to talk to the president about things and all. So he came in and saying, in the way he said it, guests are now allowed to leave. So I just did not consider that addressed to me. I just stayed put. And there's like a, he said, yeah, I mean, the guests are, and Abu Ammar himself looked at me and said, Akhuya, brother, yeah, you can't.
Abu Ammar is Yasser Arafat, the president.
Yasser Arafat, President Arafat. And I said, but Abu Ammar, I'm not a guest here. I'm an official of this authority. There's just no way am I going to leave. Just really, had he said something else? I mean, just the word guest did not sit well with me. You understand? Did not really think it was addressed to me. So we just stayed on, and it played out. The next day was very bad. Honestly, we're on the phone with Jeff many times. He can tell you about that more than I. The kind of testy exchanges, and some got in the act of trying to really get me out to go to IMF World Bank meetings, but I did not really go at the time. And I, he would remember this maybe better. I don't know, but I remember there was a point in time when there were meetings also arranged for me to meet administration officials at the margins of the four meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. And Jeff, you know, every day would say, we're getting there, until we really got to the point where if I did not go, that would cause some scheduling problems. And I remember my reaction was, you know, if the other U.S. administration is not good enough to be able to push Sharon's tanks 50 meters away from Mukata, what am I to expect? Things like that. There were exchanges like this. The next day was very testy. I mean, really, really, the next day. I don't know. Just about everybody in that room thought that was the end.
But they were destroying the building around you.
Actually, that same night, first night, for whatever reason, I kind of became sleepy. Around midnight, just wanted to go to sleep. So I never really slept there. So the president, kind of really himself, escorted me to his office in the newer side of the building. Mm-hmm. And he had a room that he actually used to sleep in and something like that. He put me in that room. And as a matter of fact, I remember kind of really, I don't know why, with all that was going on, I got sleepy. And I kind of really half awake, half asleep, kind of 2-3 in the morning, him kind of really coming back to check on me. What I do remember, though, is speaking of destruction and all, about 6 in the morning, guards knocking on the door saying, you gotta leave. There's indication the Israelis are going to really, the army is going to really be destroying structures and buildings. You have to move to the other side of the building. So I ended up on the other side of the building, which is his office. And next day, we moved in, indeed the destruction started, kind of blowing up buildings and the rest. So it was really dreadfully scary. But that evening was very scary. We got there, and then Israeli army started to mobilize very, very close to really the edge of the room we were in. They were calling on us to go out and surrender and things like that, with heavy machine gun and, you know, stopping every 10 minutes and then repeating the message again and all of that. It really, really got very, very, very tough then.
Jeff, it's interesting, you know, on the Israeli side, the Second Intifada seemed to signal the end of, I think, what we'd call the Oslo years, and really transition to a very different period in that process. From the American perspective, it was also the end of a very difficult negotiation, and Camp David, of course, was here with President Clinton leading it. Looking from a slightly macro perspective, you were following things for a long time and have been since. But what changed? What's different from 1999 to 2001? What's the sea change there?
I'm not sure that we were honest enough to admit to ourselves that the Oslo process was over at that time. In fact, you still saw, in terms of the U.S. positions, you still saw evolution in a way that was consistent with the Oslo process. It was, I believe it was July 2002 when George W. Bush came out in favor of a two-state solution. The two-state solution had never been officially part of U.S. policy, even if the Palestinians concluded, you know, internally that was the goal of the Oslo process. It wasn't stated in the Declaration of Principles. It wasn't stated in the interim agreement, that two-state solution. You know, George W. Bush in July 2002 put the U.S. firmly on the position of a two-state solution. He did that at the same time that he also withdrew the relationship with Yasser Arafat himself because of what he saw as a very ambiguous response at best to the terrorism launched in the Second Intifada. But there was still a sense that as bad as things were, there was still going to be forward momentum. They had set up, the U.S. was the initiator of the quartet. That was Russia, the U.N., the EU, and the United States that put together a roadmap for a two-state solution that had obligations on both sides. There was still a sense that somehow you could put this all together. And I will say, in part, this was credit to the type of relationship that Salam himself, or the confidence that the U.S. had in Salam's role inside the Palestinian Authority. You know, for example, you know of all the congressional restrictions on assistance to the Palestinians, you know, that's, you know, linked to commitment to peace and all sorts of things, Salam was able to build the type of relationships with the U.S. administration and particularly with the U.S. Congress where we were able to transfer cash to the Palestinian Authority to pay for essential services. That would have been unheard of had Salam not put in place in the Palestinian Authority real fiduciary transparency and been able to persuade skeptics on Capitol Hill that he could be responsible for the use of those funds. So I don't think that we concluded, as awful as the Intifada was, that the process was basically over.
So do you think, Jeff, though, that what happens afterwards is basically, in a sense, in what sense does Oslo continue? What is it about Oslo that survives? And I guess thinking even today, what is it that still survives from Oslo? I suppose one is just the Palestinian Authority itself. That still exists. But do you think there's anything that survives even now after the Second Intifada and after all these years that have passed since?
I'll let Salam answer that.
A lot to say. I want to recall the earlier part about the siege, although many, many other stories without mentioning human relations in all of this. In particular, Jeff's own role, household name in my own household. He was on the phone with my wife and kids every day, just reassuring them and talking to them and all of that. And we did have a warm personal relationship, family to family, before, but that really was something that my family never forget, and I will always be in his debt for it. I mean, it's just remarkable. There was that kind of, it was the complexity, it was the violence. Things appeared to be unraveling at all levels. But there was some channel that's out there, that's active. There's some communication, there's some back and forth, and people listen to each other in the worst of circumstances. Something which, with deep sorrow, I say, is virtually non-existent now. So, yeah, those days were tough, and we thought they were really difficult days. But now, by contrast, where we are today, they look like and sound like the good old days. And they were not good. They may not be that old either, which brings me to the question of where I see things going. Your question specifically was to what is it that's left of Oslo? You suggested the PA itself. It's a creation of Oslo. It's still there. Yes, it is. It does exist, but in what shape? It really has been getting progressively weaker and weaker and weaker. You know, Palestinian leadership undermined in a political sense by the failure of the Oslo Accord. And you know what, when I first used the phrase doctrinal failure, I essentially was referring to the PLO having made a bet on Oslo to produce a Palestinian state in 5 years, something which the Oslo framework and accords themselves are silent on. Mm-hmm. As Jeff said, it was not before George W. Bush actually made that statement in June of 2002 about that being the desired outcome, two states living side by side in peace and security, that it became declared, publicly declared U.S. policy. Not a small thing, as was not a small thing, what Jeff said about Congress of the United States actually getting to the point of disbursing cash into coffers of the PA at a time when nobody thought that's something they could even begin to talk about. And in this context, there's this one congressman that I really have to pay a special tribute to, Howard Berman, and his role on Capitol Hill at the time. I remember in 2003, remember Jeff even mentioned the year, was really early on. I had been in office less than a year, and we met at the margins of an event at the Dead Sea on the Jordanian side. And I just briefed them about what we are doing. I had good rapport with Congress because just basically, they were interested in what we were doing, what our plans were, what the problems we were facing. And I just really kept it, you know, that level, within the confines of, you know, the basic stuff that I really felt I was in charge of.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah.
About the reform?
I mean, one simple thing you did. Yeah. You put the Palestinian Authority budget, the expenditures, on the web so that there was transparency. Yeah. The Palestinian citizens could see.
And a demand for bank accounts for all employees.
A lot of serious reforms that actually took place. And contrary to the prevailing wisdom about the genesis and history of reform, I really do think it's important to kind of state it as it was, even if that's really not the consensus feeling as to what the case was. I can tell you now that you mentioned something about the salaries being paid into bank accounts as opposed to brown bags and cash payments and petroleum and oil and monopolies and total lack of transparency, no accountability whatsoever, and things like this. I can tell you, because I was there, that most of what needed to be done to put together a well-functioning public finance system happened when Abu Ammar was still president. I mean, I say this for the history books. I was there, and this is my own testimony. I mean, people don't think so, and they think it just basically what happened was a continuation of what was happening before, but that's the reality. The salaries you talked about happened when he was president. Consolidation of accounts happened when he was president. Preparing meaningful budgets and publishing them, including his own the budget for his own office, happened when he was a consolidation of the Palestinian Authority's commercial operations in one holding company type structure under the chairmanship of Minister of Finance happened with his own signature. So all of these things happened there. It took doing and discussion, consultation, back and forth. We persevered, but things happened. And that really helped in conversation with Congress, because you come to Congress and instead of just coming, we're broke, we need money. Need to really do some reforms. We need to prepare a budget. But it's very difficult, ladies and gentlemen, to prepare a budget. Why is that? Well, we can't really prepare a budget when two-thirds of our revenues are blocked by Israel, withheld by the government of Israel.
This is under an agreement where Israel takes the customs on behalf of the Palestinian Authority and then transfers it, but it's sometimes withheld.
So that really begins to be something people begin to relate to as an essential ingredient to empowerment, to enabling this budding kind of effort at, toward reform and improving things work. And so it's not really stated in terms of the right and wrong of it. Of course, I thought it was wrong. But the idea was, I can't really prepare. I can't really have any meaningful accountability if we don't have a budget to really tell people, where the money comes from. Coining along the way phrases like people's money and things like this, looking for things that resonate with people to really generate, build a constituency for reform, things like that. Very interesting period. So in short order, we were able to really do things quickly. So by the time I actually made it to Washington, D.C., after that siege, because stayed through it all until it ended. And then Jeff kind of made the arrangements for a meeting. I remember my first meeting with the senior most leadership in the United States happened in October of that year, after that September siege and all, met the Secretary of State, then Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice as National Security Advisor to the President, Vice President, and Congress. We started that conversation. By that time, we had things, because Jeff had contacted me some 2 months after I became, 2 weeks, sorry, after I became Minister of Finance, said, there's this trip to Washington that we think is kind of really useful for you, Minister of Interior, and all to go discuss your plans. And my reaction was, I have just started to do things. I still don't have a story to tell. And by agreement, we agreed to defer that. And I actually did not go, which was actually remarkable in the history of Palestinian-American relationship. Palestinian official invited to go to Washington saying, I'm not ready to come here. but sort of really paid off, because the time I showed up, I had something. And in those discussions, talking to Congress people at the time, and they were listening. We had these plans, we have these designs, we have these impediments, we have these problems, and all of that actually, by the way, the withholding money got resolved by December of that year. And involvement by the president himself, interest on his part, played a key role. And good act of diplomacy on the part of then ambassador to Israel in Tel Aviv, Dan Kurtzer.
Dan Kurtzer.
It was very effective in the way he communicated that message. It happened.
Well, and by December, you had a track record.
Yeah.
You were able to show that wasn't just hockey fadi, empty talk in Arabic, but you were able to actually deliver.
Exactly.
And I think that impressed the White House. And it was something the Israelis couldn't deny because they saw it happening. But I have to say that your relationship with George W. Bush also was helped by the fact that you're a University of Texas graduate.
Yeah, I mean, there were stories about kind of my first meeting with him was in spring of 2003. This is... the sequence of the events here was my first trip was in October 2002. So the money was still withheld, just beginning to really talk about things. And people reporting to each other about what the guy said and didn't he say. I was in the old executive office building, a meeting, and then I was told that the vice president wants to see you at the time. It was October 2002. None of it was kind of on the agenda. And I remember, I don't know if you still remember this or not, that after that trip, and saw Congress, there were a lot of reporting on this in many ways. And so Jeff, he still was at the time acting consul general, and he said that the president was briefed on your meetings. You know, this was important to the administration at the time. They talked about this the situation room, and they discussed issues and all. Said, can't say a situation room without remembering that story. Call us if you need something.
But, you remember, yes.
But we'll keep that for another time. But anyway, it was active conversation. So the president apparently at the time quipped, saying, why did I meet the Minister of Finance? Jeff actually conveyed that to me. So my next trip to D.C. was in spring of 2003. And it happened. Jeff calls me up and says, there's... You know, America or Washington wants to really talk to someone. We discussed the Prime Minister of Mazen at the time, in all likelihood.
Mahmoud Abbas.
The current president.
He was Prime Minister at the time, and I was Minister of Finance. And lo and behold, yeah, I was somebody representing then Prime Minister to go. And I did come to Washington at the time. And all of this, Abu Ammar, Yasser Arafat, President Arafat was still around. And you know, before I came back from any travel, I'd go stop there and ask if he needed something and things like that. So I ended up about with that relationship and history of that. So a lot of stuff was written about this. I mean, the chemistry was just great. And so people started to really speculate. So at some point, I was a classmate of Colin Powell, and at another, went to Texas together with George W. Bush, the University of Texas.
And none of it was true.
None of it is true, but the Texas connection was very powerful in the way my first encounter with George W. Bush took
place. You use those Longhorn.
Oh, yeah.
Longhorn symbols.
You maintain the confidence of Yasser Arafat up until, you know, the end of Yasser Arafat's life. You were able to maintain it. How did you answer the critics that said that you were becoming too close to us?
You know, to his credit, I have to tell you, to his credit, he saw that as I saw it myself. Because a lot of, you know, oftentimes during those days, summer of 2002 and early on 2003 and all, there were all of these stories about me being the choice of the West, of Washington and even Israel. And sometimes people going as far as suggesting to really be the successor to Yasser Arafat and things like this. Even at the time when the post of prime minister was being introduced, my name was circulating as that first prime minister, and things happened. You know, I never had any illusion as to who I was, what I was there to do, or anything like that. And to be honest with you, on that, during that round, I said, not my job. You know, I'm here to do the books. And all, I just got here. A lot of people who have been doing this for a long time had me on all of that. So I sat this one out, obviously. I mean, it went the way it did. And throughout, I was really completely preoccupied with doing those things that really needed to be done right. He knew from my relationship with him, while I was IMF Res Rep, that I really had the interest of getting things done right from Palestinian point of view at heart. And from my days, going back, my days at the IMF, I always kind of took advantage of my many meetings with him to kind of talk about the need to reform things, particularly as we started to get close to permanent status negotiations. We had many good meetings and all. So he kind of really had a sense of what this is about. There were many stories I can tell you. It was kind of really, as a matter of fact, it was his, the way he kind of perceived himself made it possible for him to really absorb this. This is someone who would get, pieces of paper with them, on them, written stories about, look at what's happening, this guy is becoming really too influential about me, look at what New York Times is saying, the un-Arafat PA official, pictures and all. And, you know, all he'd do is, I remember it kind of with his pen, he was just a Dr. Salam, he just kind of refers them to me and all that. Had a kind of really close relationship. I had a lot of empathy, and it showed. When I really said no to him, it pained me. One of the kind of conversation I recall, like it was a high-pitched conversation with Jeff on the other end of it, was really toward the end of 2002. I don't know if you remember this, but we were in the final stages of negotiating the release of our funds in Israel, held by Israel. And we're getting close to end of Ramadan and Eid, and for whatever reason, President Arafat at the time wanted salaries paid before Eid, and I just simply did not have the resources and did not want to do what he wanted to do, which is to really get a loan from our central bank, which is something, a loan from pension fund, and I did not want to do that either. And here I was kind of 3-4 month old minister in Abu Ammar's cabinet, kind of saying, no, I wouldn't do these things. And I was counting on a breakthrough on the Israeli side. And on that day, and I kept postponing the inevitable encounter between him on something like this. I knew it was big on his mind. And every cabinet meeting we had, or so-called leadership meeting, he would say, you know, I have the papers ready, so your brother Salam and I would sign and get this done. And I pretend as if I really did not hear, and avoid him. Day of reckoning, at 10 a.m., the phone started ringing off the hook. And I told my secretary to tell Mukhata I was at the bank. I was not at the bank. And then, but kind of midday, I thought, come on now, inshallah, I should be better than to just basically continue to run away from this. I went there. And by the time I made it to Mukhata on my own, by the time I made it there, of course, a lot of things on my mind. I mean, I knew he must be really totally angry, furiously angry and all. And I knew what it was like when he got angry at someone. I mean, inshallah. So I had a little bit of a piece of paper and scribbled a letter of resignation, put it in my book, because I figured, something bad is going to happen, or I just kind of drop this letter and move on. I'm not really going to take abuse from anyone, not even the president and all. And I remember that they just walked in, and everything's going, the president's looking for you, the president is looking for us. I know. And I was really encouraged. So I walk in, he was alone in his room with that oval table there. I don't know if you have recollection of it, but by that time, Americans were not actually going to Mukhata. The last meeting that took place there was Secretary Powell in, I believe, spring of 2002. You know, Secretary of State at the time. It was the last meeting at that level. Anyway, but he was kind of pacing. And I saw that he was really trying to not kind of yell. I could tell. And I said, where have you been, brother? He was really making an effort to kind of contain himself. I said, will you please sit down, Mr. President? I said, I know this is really painful. I know it's been on my mind. I know that you've really been saying that you need to pay salaries. I know you care. But on my way here, I called in on radio myself, and I said salaries are not going to be made, and I myself take full responsibility for it as Minister of Finance. It's my responsibility. And something else I need to tell you. These two instruments, one is illegal, and one I would not really recommend about those two borrowing instruments. And it would be much better, and I do this passionately, just as I'm doing it now, I'd much rather have you been known as someone who so desperately wanted to pay salaries, but did not to uphold some principles, rather than satisfy an immediate need to pay today. What are we going to do tomorrow? What are we going to do next month? He was quiet, didn't say anything. I sat there, not knowing what to do. And then I decided to just carry my little self and leave. Did this happen? Nothing bad. I went back to my office really sad. I mean, not in any way gratified that
with
nothing.
But the letter still in your pocket.
Yeah, letter never really was brandished. I mean, I didn't have to. That was kind of last resort. I mean, if something really bad happened, how am I going to really, you know, sit down and just kind of be on the receiving end of major abuse? So I'm not going to do that. But I didn't have to really reach out to the letter. Nothing like that. Just, he was quiet. Just, and I left. I go to my office. And Jeff called. And I said, oh, breakthrough. I was doing this, you know, playing for time. And of course, Jeff, every day I'd call him, you know, tell Dan, tell everybody. I mean, you know, we're just getting to the end. I mean, it's really, it's a problem. There are just massive pressures. We can't really deal with this. Why are the Israelis, you know, stalling so much? We agreed. Can't they really do this? Can they do that? But Jeff was, I said, ah, alhamdulillah. So we have a resolution. Except that Jeff, at the time, said, can you give me a fax number? So, and he mentioned that Israeli official's name. He wanted to send you a letter. And I got really angry. Mm-hmm. It's like, letter? You know, when I'm really expecting money to be transferred, what they want to send me is a letter? I don't want a letter. That whole frustration, that whole kind of state of mind reflected, and this really should go, I'm saying this to answer your question, the extent to which I was really saddened and angered by being put in this position of being unable to do something, the heavy weight of injustice in all facets of it. And I said, and I'm sure he did, I said, tell Washington, if they are not good enough to get the Israelis to release our own money, what good is there to really be expected of them? And I'm sure he did. That's my own message. My own.
I think so, I might have softened it a little bit. Yeah.
But you know, it, basically he knew. He knew. So I had this letter to do that. I mean, his last phone conversation before he passed was with me, actually, on my side. In any event, that's how it was done. But the Texas connection was kind of really something. In the context of that meeting or trip to Washington, I was sitting with, still at the time, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice in her office. Phone rings in her office, and she says, I was there with an aide to President, then Prime Minister Abbas. She said, this is something that you and I have to do alone. I said, oh, okay. And I didn't know we were going to. I never really been to the Oval Office or something like that. And so we kind of walk around. So we get there, and lo and behold, I'm in the Oval Office, and somebody's just walking toward me doing this. The Texas Longhorn signs. That's the genesis of this kind of people that start to think, oh, they went to school together or something. In any event, it wasn't that. But there was good chemistry and things.
So we have to wrap. And so I want to sort of, you know, we're thinking of these years and the attempts at reform. And of course, looking back at them now from the years now, there's a tragedy to it. So much work was done and yet so much destroyed in the Second Intifada. You know, of course, the Israeli perspective of the same Yasser Arafat became very negative, especially after the Second Intifada. But I'm wondering, we're thinking about it from where we are today, end of 2018. Jeff, you served in many embassies. You were ambassador to Lebanon, you served in Baghdad, and you were assistant secretary of NEA. Salam, you've spent a lot of time throughout the Middle East. Today, it seems like the Palestinian issue, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is at best a second-order issue. Most countries, most people in politics, at least, are interested in other issues. Is this a fair description, Jeff? Is that true, and can it last? Will it last?
I mean, I have to say that during my time at the United Nations, unless there was a hot conflict like a Gaza conflict, the Europeans who visited the Secretary General in meetings I attended tended to bring up the Palestinians more than the Arabs did. Jordan's an exception. Jordan always would start off, any Jordanian official would start off the meeting talking about the Palestinians. But in general, it was off the radar screen by those leaders that you would think would have a, or at least rhetorically have a great interest in the solution. So I think it is a problem, except when things are hot. But the problem is, can things not get hot, given the current lack of horizon? At some point, it's going to get hot again.
And what kind of horizon do you think might be possible today? Is it fair to say, a lot of people say, you know, 25 years after Oslo now, two-state solution is, it's a pipe dream. It was irrelevant years ago, and we should be thinking about completely different things. If there would be any resolution, some say one state, they call it a solution perhaps, some say a confederacy, some say no solution at all. Where do you stand, Jeff?
This is not very imaginative. When I go through the list of possible solutions, I still come up and say, well, perhaps it's hard, but the least problematic is a two-state solution. But right now, the positions of the two sides are absolutely irreconcilable. The Israeli positions do not give the minimum requirements that the Palestinians could accept. And facts are changing on the ground all the time. Politically, the two-state solution, it seems to me, is still the best for both the Israelis and the Palestinians. But how you implement it with the lack of trust and with the changes on the ground and the current political environments, frankly, among both the Israelis and the Palestinians, I don't know.
Saddam, is it still possible?
You know, I largely agree on with Jeff, what he said about the two-state solution. And I especially agree with him on what has been a problem for a long period of time, except that it has become more problematic with the passage of time, namely the maximum on offer by Israel not being anywhere near the minimum acceptable to Palestinians, essentially.
Does that include Annapolis?
That includes everything. And the problem, I think, got progressively worse in some ways because, you know, when the state did not happen by the presumptive date when it was supposed to happen, end of the interim agreement itself.
According to what the Palestinians interpreted.
Because that was really bad because, you know, the critics at the time said, how in God's name did we agree to something like this? And the answer was, or how come we did not insist on settlement freeze, for example? How come we did not insist on the release of our prisoners? How come? And the answer was, wait 4 years, we're 2 and 1 year. We have a state, and it doesn't really matter. So with all of its imperfections, I mean, the conventional wisdom was, you know, 5 years later from start date, we're going to have a state. When that did not happen, that was really a huge problem. But by the time it did not happen, it was also beginning to be clear that the prospects of that happening anytime soon were a lot dimmer than they were then years earlier. And that was kind of, you know, that's what I really remember, I said, doctrinal failure. PLO had bet, you know, the house on that program delivering statehood. It didn't. It became a lot weaker, does not really have the constituency it once did, the capacity to really represent with strength and all of that sort of thing, weakened by a process that did not produce. But where does that leave us? I know this has been really visited many times under the heading of, well, if it's not two states, then one state and all. To this day, some people whom I really regard as serious observers and analysts talk about one state reality and all. I honestly do not know if they really have thought that through. I myself beg to differ with all of this analysis. I mean, I could be in a minority of one. I don't know, because most everybody I talk to seems to think, well, you know, two-state did not happen. Israel has been difficult, particularly with respect to settlement activity, and the rest of it did not give on anything. So there's no possibility physically for a person. So it's going to be one state. I beg to really question this. And you know, the fact that two-state solution concept did not produce a two-state reality does not impart automaticity to one-state solution or to a one-state reality that's acceptable. I mean, it could produce one-state reality. That's not acceptable, especially from our point of view, Palestinians. We can't be too sanguine about, well, two-state didn't work out, fine, let's just wait it out. We're kind of, even today, outnumber Jews in the Holy Land. And so, therefore, one state and one man, one vote, one woman, one vote, one person, one vote. That kind of really thinking. I mean, somebody other needs to really tell me that there is automaticity to this in some way. I just don't see it. So it seems to me more of a cop-out than anything else. I don't see a one-state reality. And for those who really go to Bibi Netanyahu and say, we know better, essentially, you're doing the wrong thing from Israel's point of view, because, you know, Israel can never be both Jewish and democratic at the same time unless Palestinians have their state. They assume that Bibi Netanyahu has the same worldview on a solution concept that they do. He doesn't. I don't think he does. And what we have is a reality of status quo that seems to be actually the default. We don't have one state reality. I think we have more like three or four state reality. One state look-alike Palestinian in Gaza, another Palestinian state look-alike on 40% of the West Bank, give or take, maybe add to it a little bit, Then you have the settler enterprise of Israel and some 60% of the West Bank. And then you have Israel of 1948. What Israel is foregoing, and I think consciously foregoing, is the possibility, and what was the requirement or expectation under Oslo, end of conflict resolution. End of conflict resolution, meaning a deed signed onto by Palestinians. Now, Israel must know that not the current leadership, not any future leadership, Palestinian leadership, could possibly sign on to something like this. It seems to me the calculus is the political cost associated with running it as it is not as high, is lower than moving on considering political realities in Israel right now. So that really is what I see. It doesn't mean that there's going to be stability forever. It doesn't, but it seems to me that effectively is what's happening. So there's nothing good about this for us. Waiting is just not really a good idea from my point of view until something happens. I don't see good things happening on the path we are on right now.
So where does this leave us now with the last question with American policy right now? On the one hand, the Trump administration has been hinting that it will release its version of the ultimate deal anytime soon. On the other hand, very dramatic steps, breaking with tradition on the embassy to Israel, moving to Jerusalem, cutting aid to the Palestinian Authority, to the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Does either of you see a prospect of serious movement in the near future? And isn't this, you know, the consensus I hear here of two-state solution is still possible? Maybe that flies in the face of what we're seeing right now in reality?
I mean, I was intrigued by President Trump's comment after his meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu in New York on the margin of the General Assembly, where he said that he would prefer a two-state solution, which before he said, you know, he would do whatever the parties wanted to do. I was intrigued by that because my interpretation has been that the Trump administration is very deliberately going sequentially and taking every final status issue off the table, or trying to take every final status issue off the table, and then using the Palestinian reaction to then blame the Palestinians. You take Jerusalem off the table, you cut the assistance, you put a question mark over the question of refugees, all that, and then the Palestinians refuse to talk to the American officials. You use that refusal to then close down the Palestinian representation office in Washington, and probably they'll go after the consulate general in Jerusalem for all on the same grounds. So you use the Palestinian reaction to your policies in order to then blame the Palestinians for what's happening. So I believe that they're sequentially going through issue by issue to try to take final status issues off the table. I don't think it will work over the long term, but I think that's what the...
Hold on briefly. Any chance now?
No chance. You know, Palestinians would agree to something like this. I mean, again, you know, this whole... I mean, if we really take in what has happened so far on the path to rolling out the plan, clearly that cannot really be good news, not only for Palestinians themselves, not only for us, but I think for all of those who really, at one point or another, especially those who still believe that a two-state solution can happen, because there are serious issues with this. So to think that with that kind of really beginning, contrasted with several other beginnings at this before, attempts at this, we're going to really land in a better place. That's a major supposition, to be honest with you. So it remains to be seen what happens. But, you know, this said, to be honest with you, there is an issue. I mean, there is at some point a need for serious people to really ask the right questions. I mean, if there is at all seriousness about this. We tend to all get sucked into the last thing that's said, or sometimes not said, as I once was myself, when I found out that the Republican Party's platform for the last election did not have what had become by then traditional reference to two-state solution. And what I found more disturbing at the time was the negotiation history that led to it being deleted. That was there in the draft, was deleted, and all of that. And I saw that as an ominous sign. And now the president is saying, well, he sort of liked the two-state solution took a long time. And you can, you know, complain about this. And the risk I see is sometimes that pushes us too much in the direction of somehow thinking that things were kind of okay until this last bad thing happened. Well, things were not okay Up until this last bad thing happened. Things were not okay. Things were not on the right. So we can't really get ourselves in this kind of really mindset. It keeps postponing the day of reckoning. The moment of reckoning when we really have to ask ourselves a fundamental question. Is there anything that can seriously be done about this under any heading whatsoever? Now we say two states. One of these two states has been around for 7 decades. Let's really begin to actually change the labels. You know, redefine things in a way that can be operationalized in a meaningful way. Instead of continuing to say two-state solution, something which people became desensitized to, highly skeptical of. Two-thirds of us in Palestine are millennials or just under, born before the 10th century and all that. They're extremely, skeptical, with good reason, totally disenfranchised. So he keeps saying this and don't mean anything. But what if you say, context of two-state solution negotiated, yes, but one of these two states has been around for 7 decades. Why don't we really make central the question, what is it that needs to be done in order for that other state to emerge and define everything on the basis of defining the goal in this way? That begins to kind of really, and I'm not really saying this in order to dodge, Palestinian responsibility. I'll be the first one to say this is what we Palestinians should lead with. And first order of business, when you really define things this way, is what is it that we Palestinians are prepared to commit in order to deliver on what we believe is a unifying national objective of having a sovereign, independent, fully independent state on the territory Israel occupied in 1967, beginning with the act that only we can do it, that's building that state. That really begins to define it in an entirely different way.
That was your philosophy as prime minister. Yeah. As prime minister, you were not involved in the political talks, but what you were involved with was trying to build the state from the ground up, the institutions that a state would require, the credible, transparent, accountable institutions. You were trying to basically, as all of us were over here at one table dealing with the politics, you were over here quietly building that state, expecting that the institutions could then be moved into the political process once there was an overall solution.
So on that note of both, I think, extreme pessimism about where we are at the moment in one respect, but also sort of an understanding that things often look bad and sometimes good comes when you don't expect it. It's not actually true that it's darkest just before dawn, but it is true that often good things come in surprise. And in the spirit of what you just said, Jeff, of looking for pragmatic solutions, which is certainly something that we at Brookings aspire to, of serious policy, it looks for pragmatic solutions. Let me conclude by saying a huge thank you and, again, a huge belated welcome to both of you here to Brookings, Jeffrey Feldman and the Honorable Salam Fayyad. Thank you both very much and for joining me as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. You can find more episodes of Intersections and the rest of the Brookings Podcast Network on Apple or Google Podcasts, on Spotify, CastBox, Stitcher, or your other favorite podcast app. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter @PolicyPodcasts for news and updates.